Chapter 24. Petra woke to Saturday in a common inn room close to a place called Sevenoaks. She was relieved not to be itching, for she discovered the unpleasant side of this form of travel. The wagon passengers had all slept together, each on a narrow mattress on the floor, along with four other travellers. There'd been a baby who'd woken twice, and the old man had snored. All the same, she'd had some fairly decent sleep. She ate a simple breakfast with the rest, and then climbed back into the wagon for her second day. She wouldn't reach Guildford today, but she'd be there tomorrow, Sunday. It began to rain, proving that England wasn't always idyllic, but she was dry and safe inside the wagon and counted her blessings. By now, Robin would have her message, so she could stop worrying about him. That didn't quite happen, but she managed not to think about him, at least part of the time. Robin woke to anxiety fueled by vaguely remembered dreams of struggling to reach Petra, who was crying out for help amid dancers wearing Venetian masks. Chasing Vartzi wasn't easing him when there was no sniff of the man yet, and his own doctor was coming soon to inspect his wound. Every sense said it was healing, but he still broke into a cold sweat when he remembered his father's suffering. He got out of bed to test his leg again. It was sore and the stitches pulled, but he could move around reasonably well with the stick. It had to be all right. But when Dr. Wright was announced, his heart pumped. Wright was his family's London physician and knew the story. He looked both grave and disapproving. "I can't wrap myself in flannel," Robin wanted to protest, as the man unbandaged his leg. But he knew there was a lot of ground between swaddling and dueling. He sat up to look for himself, trying to persuade himself that the ugly, sewn gash was in good shape. He wasn't sure until Wright muttered, "Better than you deserve, sir." "Perhaps actually good?" The man looked at him sternly, but then relaxed into a smile. "Very good, my lord, but you're damned lucky. You, above all, should know." "I know life is chancy and might as well be enjoyed." The doctor sighed and rebandaged the wound, leaving strict instructions to take things gently and alert him at any sign of increased pain or fever. Having thus diluted his optimistic opinion, he took his leave. Robin decided to take the positive point of view and celebrate by hobbling downstairs for breakfast. Thorne was equally delighted by the assessment, and they ate with some merriment as they pored over the newspapers. There was the advertisement, responses to be sent to a legal office not previously connected to him or the Duke of Eythorn. "I can't wait to see Vartzi locked up for highway robbery." "It won't stick," Thorne warned. "I'll make it stick for a while," Robin said, "and then think of some other reason to hold him. Why haven't we heard from Christian about Italians at Richmond Lodge?" "Because the whole world hasn't stopped to attend to your business. Eat." Robin picked up his café au lait and sipped. "No news from the watch on the coaching roads?" "None. Coffee isn't food." Robin took a bun and buttered it. "It's as if she's not travelled by coach, but..." Thorne spoke gently. "If she were dead, someone would have found her body." "Perhaps. She's merely disappeared efficiently. Perhaps she's an old hand at it." Robin wanted to object, but the same idea was growing in his mind. Petra had slipped away from Lady Sodworth without much of a qualm. Perhaps she'd found another protector. Perhaps she was behaving with him as she had at Montreuil and on the Coulee. After all, she hadn't been a virgin, and how could a gently raised foreign lady evade his search without help? "I doubt she was ever a nun," he said. Consider how she left her rosary and cross behind without a twitch. Perhaps she thought that funny. Thorn, wisely, didn't attempt a response. She used claws, pistols, swords. Claws? Thorn queried. Robin almost scratched at the healing scabs on his shoulder. And wounded Vartz's man at an unthinkable spot. I thought that gave you some satisfaction. Robin swigged coffee without tasting it. She probably discarded that cloak within a furlong of the farm and got rid of the gown shortly after. To wander naked, quite likely. No, but she'd find something else easily enough. After all, I'm not the first protector she used and abandoned. Lady Sodworth, Thorn said, the intolerable harpy with a voice like a screeching peacock. A commitment is a commitment. Which, according to you, the Sodworth woman broke in many ways. Robin pounded the table. If I only knew what she was really up to, then I could put her out of my mind. As you don't, put her out of your mind anyway. Thorn didn't expect him to agree to that, so Robin did out of sheer perversity. Excellent advice. I'll hold a card party tonight. Here? Thorn asked. Is my house available for rent, then? No, at my house. It's time for me to go home. I'm not the fugitive, after all. Thorn leaned back, mouth tight. I don't suppose Vartzi, you do remember Vartzi, will really attempt to kidnap you and torture the wayward Contessina's whereabouts out of you. I only wish he'd try. Struth, you madman. But if that's the way of it, I demand a return of hospitality. I want to be in at the kill. Done. Just to make sure of it, I'll let the papers know of my entertainment. How? Ah, yes. He snapped his fingers and Coquette danced over to be fed a tidbit. I'm sure it will amuse the world that I've acquired such a dog. Petra approached the end of her second day in the wagon bored and prey to many doubts. In Milan, full of her mother's substantial memories of her lover and spurred on by very real fear, it had seemed reasonable to seek out her English father. Now, with endless time to think, all the unlikely aspects grew in her mind. Why should any man remember an impetuous liaison during a wild Venetian festival 22 years ago? In her mother's memories, it had been a unique event. But to that merry young man, the naughty Contessa di Baldino would have been only a passing amusement. He'd probably been very like Robin Bonchurch. Had he been as appalled by impetuous loving? Had he been as courteous afterward, trying to conceal the truth? When she thought back to Robin after the ship, she couldn't help seeing only kindness and courtesy and obligation. He'd be hunting her under the same pressures, that was all. She completely understood his position, for she'd been raised under the same code. There were people one married and people one did not, and any marriage was to serve the family, not personal taste. She was thinking about Robin again. She turned her mind to Lord Hrothgar, troublesome though that was. If he remembered, even if he remembered with fondness, why should he believe that she was his child? Hidden in the spine of her prayer book was a short letter from her mother attesting to the fact. But would that impress? Showing him that picture of his eye would mean nothing. Her mother had said she resembled him, but similarities between a young woman and a mature man couldn't be so marked. Did she have any absolute proof to offer? No. She even began to wonder if her mother had been correct. She couldn't believe that she'd lie, but over time, might she have become mistaken? Had there only been the one lover when she'd been so very unhappy in her marriage? Or were there more? After all, her best friend had been Teresa Eamer, who had never been quite respectable. Could a woman shift the truth over time to suit romantic notions or a guilty conscience? When they stopped for the night in Dorking, Petra found the common bedroom intolerably crowded and noisy, and went out after supper to find some peace. That wasn't easy, because the White Horse was a busy coaching inn, so she walked a little way down the road, tussling with her future. She was learning much about herself, including that she enjoyed company but would choose solitude over some people. It would be horrible not to have choice. If her father rejected her, she would need to find work. She might find a position as a lady's companion if she were lucky, but the lady might be someone like Lady Sodworth. She'd likely hang for murder before the year was out. She'd survive in a convent, but she'd learned by now that Robin had told the truth. There were no monasteries or convents here, and the English were wary of papists, as they called Catholics. She said her prayers silently and never crossed herself. She wasn't afraid of menial work, but she wasn't trained for anything except the elementary nursing of the poor. There was always Robin, and she had promised to ask his help if she needed it, but she didn't know what to expect from him or what she could endure. She could not be his whore, but it would be almost as intolerable to be in his orbit with nothing. Shadows were lengthening, so she turned back toward the inn. The words of the psalm invaded her mind. Si ambulem in medio umbrae mortis, known to Mabo Marla. Though I walk in the shadow of death, I will not be afraid. She had to step back sharply to avoid a speeding coach that halted at the White Horse, and the dangerous moment made her laugh. There were practical reasons to be afraid of walking in shadows. She watched the public coach disgorge passengers and their luggage and consume others, all people with purpose in their lives. She asked an ostler what vehicle it was.
"Why, that's the Guildford Flyer, that is, miss, and with Mighty Mike Cockcroft on the box. Be there inside 2 hours tonight, it will."
Cock. Petra looked from the dusty, laden coach to a short, burly man downing a huge tankard of something while flirting with an adoring maid. 2 hours to Guildford. "Would I still be able to buy a seat on it?" she asked.
"Aren't you from the wagon?"
"Yes, but I have some money."
"I'll ask, but you'll have to be quick, though, miss. Mighty Mike won't wait."
Petra ran in and up to the sleeping room, where she grabbed her bundle, giving a quick explanation to her fellow travellers. She ran back down to find the coachman on the box, reins in hand.
"Up on top for a shilling," the ostler said. "Hurry up, you can pay him at the other end."
Petra scrambled up the ladder to squeeze in between two men. The coach immediately jerked into action, and she was glad to be jammed in so tight. The flyer turned onto the Guildford Road and picked up speed, the groom on the box blasting a long note on his horn to celebrate the fact. She grabbed onto the sleeve of the man to her right. He didn't seem to mind.
"Petra! Petra! Only think what happened last time you acted on impulse!"
"I escaped," she told her protesting mind. "If I'd stayed with Lady Sodworth, I'd be back in Milan by now, or more likely dead in an effort to escape." And cocks were her good luck symbol. She saw a weathercock on a clock tower, pointing west. "Follow the cock. Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross." Whatever that was, if all else failed, she'd go there to seek her fortune. Robin had forgotten that a return to his house would mean a return to duties, but as soon as his secretary, Trevelyan, expressed his delight with his good health, he began to mention correspondence and documents to be signed, as well as something Robin should read about the situation between Austria and Prussia. Austria ruled Milan, Robin instantly thought, but pushed the connection aside. He'd deal with Varzi, but wouldn't waste any more time on Petra. She'd made her choice. He, on the other hand, had no choice. Trevelyan could be as demanding as a tutor, probably because he'd been Robin's tutor, but also because he was always right. After going through the most urgent matters, Robin lost control of one impulse. If anything comes that mentions Italy, I want to see it. Trevelyan was at a nearby table, applying Robin's seal with precision to correspondence already dealt with.
Italy, sir?
Italy. You know, that long country that looks like a boot.
Yes, sir.
Damn. Robin never sank to sarcasm, and Trevelyan had probably picked up some of his ridiculous adventures. He still considered it his duty to keep informed about all Robin's affairs. Were they done? Trevelyan brought over one remaining letter, the seal unbroken. Robin saw at a glance that it was from his mother.
Why didn't you give me this first?
His secretary was staring at the far wall, his face rather pink.
I took the liberty of informing the Countess of your wound, my lord.
Rare anger flared.
Damn your black heart! It's a mere jab. But you know how she'll worry. I should dismiss you on the spot.
Trevelyan went from pink to white, his face pinching.
Her ladyship particularly requested that I inform her of any wounds, sir.
And a man could hardly dismiss his mother.
Oh, go away,
Robin growled, and snapped the seal on the heavy paper. She'd be worrying herself sick.
Struth,
he muttered, then shouted, Trevelyan, get back here. The man returned immediately, alarmed in a new way.
Mother's arriving tomorrow, travelling on Sunday even. Tell Mistress Dunscape to prepare her rooms and, oh, do whatever else is needed.
Yes, sir.
My apologies, sir.
Oh, hell. If I were in a bad way, she'd want to be here, and I suppose she'll be delighted to see me well. When the secretary had left, Robin rose to pace the room, but halted at the pane. A knock at the door brought the well-scrubbed kitchen boy who'd just been elevated to dog care. He put Coquette down, and she ran to Robin in her usual fervour of devotion.
Not you again, Robin muttered, but picked up the dog. Petra was right. I'm a heartless monster, aren't I? Who has so much devotion they can afford to toss some away?
He knew the dog's sin was to remind him of Petra. He'd only had Coquette for a week when he'd met Sister Immaculata, and after that they'd shared some remarkable adventures, all three of them. He remembered to send the lad off to his other duties and sat back at his desk, putting Coquette on the surface, something she seemed to love.
Pet and Petra, he said, tilting the dog's head up, as if there might be an intelligent response in the bright eyes. Is she, unlike you, a faithless bitch?
The dog tilted her head as if thinking, but offered no wisdom.
You're finally going to be useful, though, my little nothing. With any luck, you'll alert Signor Varzi to my presence in London, and he'll emerge from hiding. Then we can pay him back for his cruelty to you.
Petra did indeed arrive in Guildford in less than 2 hours, and paid Mighty Mike Cockcroft his shilling.
What are you going to do now? He asked gruffly.
Petra hesitated. He was a weather-beaten rock of a man, but had a kindly look in his eye.
Take a bed here, sir, then continue my journey in the morning. Not back to Maidstone, I assume.
What point in concealment now?
No, to Farnham. There's a slow coach to Farnham. Shamley, the innkeeper here, will put you right for it, but it won't run tomorrow, love, it being Sunday. He touched his big hat and shambled off. Petra had no trouble getting a bed in another common room, but her spirits were low. She was stuck here until Monday, so she'd wasted her shilling, and by now she was desperate to know her fate and be able to make some sort of plan. There were only two other travellers in this room, a middle-aged woman travelling with a slow-witted daughter. When the woman struck up a conversation, Petra took part lackadaisically. "You look troubled, dear," Mistress Culler said. Wryly, Petra adapted an old story. "My mother's sick, near Farnham, and I'm rushing to her side, but with Sunday, I'll be stuck here." "But I thought you were Welsh, dear," Petra invented quickly. "My father was. When he died, my mother came back here to look after her mother, but I stayed in my position, near Monmouth." That seemed to satisfy. "No one could blame you for travelling in such a cause, dear. But it'd have to be Shank's pony." Petra's puzzlement must have shown, for the woman added, "On foot, dear. It's not much more than 10 miles, and likely you'll get a ride here and there from people going to church and visiting family." Heartened, Petra lay down to sleep, resolved to walk the 10 miles and complete her journey the next day. Robin hadn't expected many attendees in July in London, but his house was soon crowded. Those in town had sent alerts to others whose country residences were nearby. Everyone wanted details of the duel with a highwayman in broad daylight. Some men brought beautiful women of obliging natures, all of whom seemed eager to oblige him. Robin felt an alarming lack of enthusiasm and used his leg as an excuse. That didn't deter them all, and a few began to tease him about where the wound actually was. He greeted the sight of a strapping blonde gentleman in a spectacularly braided uniform as escape. "Christian," Robin declared with true enthusiasm, but not rising from his place. His leg was giving him hell. "What news of court, my friend?" "Dammy, that sounds like a line from Shakespeare." "No, that would be that shrewd and knavish sprite called Robin Goodfellow," said Major Lord Grandiston. "How did a fribble like you acquire a wound?" "Ask rather how anyone got past my impenetrable guard. You've never managed it." Christian laughed. "Very well. How?" "He was rather good."
"And dead?"
"Yes, but I can't take credit. The story's been in the papers."
"Never read 'em.
Anything really interesting is all the buzz at court."
Christian accepted wine from a servant, but said,
"Good God! What's that?"
He was looking at Coquette, who had danced out to be adored.
"Fluff," said Thorne dryly. "Someone sweep it up."
"Princess Coquette," said Robin. "I swear that her ears grow larger with admiration. She was the heroine of the hour."
"How?" Christian asked in disbelief.
"Startled my opponent at a crucial moment."
"That I can believe."
Robin summoned a hovering footman to help him up out of his chair, then grasped his walking stick.
"Let's find a quiet corner and I'll tell the tale."
"Is a quiet corner possible?" Christian asked, already bombarded with greetings and teasing about Braid from all sides.
It took time to work out of the room, but then it was a short distance to the parlour that was part of the Earl's suite of rooms. Robin still thought of them as his father's. Thorne had come with them, and of course Coquette. Robin gave his friend the true account of his Kentish adventures. Christian whistled.
"Only you, Robin. Only you."
"Why does everyone say that?"
Robin scooped up Coquette and put her on his lap.
"You take me seriously, don't you, my little papillon?"
"The dog makes you ridiculous," said Thorne. You have no appreciation of the art of frivolity. Thank God. One day, merely being a duke won't be enough to charm people.
Evidence says otherwise, Thorn said dryly.
Children, Christian chided. Back to matters of moment. Robin, you wrote to ask about Italians at Richmond Lodge. The reply is none in the past week.
No one fitting the descriptions?
No. We live very quietly.
Robin hesitated about the next question, because Petra's story was probably all lies, but he lost the struggle.
Can you think of anyone attached to the court who would have been in Italy about 22 years ago? If he really was young, then we're talking about a man close to 40 now.
Christian thought for a moment.
In London, court would be crawling with them. Nearly every peer visited Italy as a youth.
What about permanent court officers?
Not offhand. I finished my stint at court, by the way, but I know people there I can ask.
Thank you, Robin said. I doubt there's anything in it. It was all a story made up to amuse me.
I did, he recollected, stroking Coquette, demand amusement.
As always, beware what you ask for.
Good advice, Christian said, but added, is there any danger of Lady Fowler's fund increasing?
That idiotic vow we took? Struth no, said Robin, hoping he'd put the right degree of amused disbelief on it.
As he hobbled back down the corridor, he heard one of the men behind him murmur,
a side bet that the foul fund will be 1,000 richer by year's end.
That must have been Christian, because it was definitely Thorn who replied,
done. He'd never be such a fool.